This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we get an update from Pennsylvania journalist David Lindorf, who's been covering the Mumia hearing in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Mumia is in federal court asking for an injunction that would force the state of Pennsylvania to give him life-saving medicine for hepatitis C, a fatal disease. We'll also speak with Miko Pellid, the author of the book The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko has written that when I reached the conclusion that a state for Jews in a land where half of the population is not Jewish was not going to work, things changed drastically for me. He'll talk about why.
We'll speak with author Donna Haverty Stack about her new book, Trotskyists on Trial.
They were framed up and imprisoned during peacetime before the Second World War merely for being socialists.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Mumia Abu-Jamal has gone to federal court in Scranton, Pennsylvania, to get an order compelling the state of Pennsylvania to provide him with medical care for hepatitis C, a potentially fatal disease. Mumia has suffered symptoms of slurred words, elephant skin, scales, and bloody cracks in his skin on 90% of his body, extreme weakness, swelling of his limbs, and loss of mental acuity. Mumia is being represented by Brett Grody of the Abolitionist Law Center and by Robert Boyle, a National Lawyers Guild lawyer and longtime prisoners' rights advocate. We speak today with Pennsylvania reporter David Lindorf. Lindorf has been covering the ongoing Mumia hearing. The hearing before federal judge Robert Mariani has so far shown that the Corrections Department of Pennsylvania has a policy of denying any treatment for chronic hepatitis C and maintains a just revealed protocol that calls for denying care and monitoring inmates while the virus ravages the body, causing irreversible organ damage. David Lindorf, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me on.
You were at the trial the first day and you've been following it. Can you bring us up to date?
Yeah, this is a really crucial hearing for Mumia because since January, he's been having a serious medical crisis, which initially nobody understood what was wrong. His skin was turning into like what he called dragon skin, and his doctor called elephant, it looked like elephant skin, blistered, thick, dark, blacker than his natural black skin, itching like crazy. And then he also had elevated blood glucose levels that they didn't even know about because they weren't testing until he, in March, collapsed in a diabetic coma and was rushed to the hospital. And finally, they diagnosed it as diabetes, which he had never had. They treated all of this stuff symptomatically. You know, they gave him insulin. They gave him ointments for the skin. And actually, they were putting cortisone on, which is pretty dangerous to do for, you know, overuse. And finally, when he got to a hospital, they really figured it out. But what needed to be done with the diabetes. But what they didn't do was check his hepatitis infection, because when he went to the prison in 2012, to the general population prison, they did a screening and found out, as they do, I guess, for most prisoners, and they found that he had contracted hep C at some point.
Now that they know he's got hepatitis C, there's a medicine that they could give him for it. Why aren't they giving him the medicine? Isn't that what the hearing's all about?
Here's the deal. We have a new member of our This Can't Be Happening.net, Jess Gu, who's a radical young doctor at a public health clinic now in Seattle. And she looked at his records and stuff and looked into this. And she said, the situation is that normally, even outside of the prison, if you get hep C, the normal treatment has been not necessarily to treat it unless it's active, just monitor it, because there are side effects to the medications. And so if people test positive to the virus but it's not doing anything, you periodically you can get rid of it with these new medications that only take 12 weeks and the side effects aren't so bad. But it's hugely expensive. It's like $85,000 for the course of treatment. But she said it would be all right to not treat it if you're monitoring for cirrhosis of the liver or, you know, the various things that could happen and measuring viral load periodically. But they didn't do any of that with Mumia. They just said, oh, you were infected. And they never tested since 2012 to see whether how active it was. And apparently what the suspicion is that it started getting active. And when they only in May finally tested him with his blood level, and it was very high.
Isn't he now asking, though, that he be given this medicine, and they're denying it to him?
Yeah, well, this is Dr. Jess Gu said that the absolute proper treatment, according to guidelines, is if you have an active case of hep C, you don't have a choice. You have to treat it, or it'll kill you. So, you know, he should be getting treated, but in Pennsylvania, they don't treat. In some states, they do. In New York, in Connecticut, in a number of states, that they treat for hep C if it's an active case. I think in some states, they actually treat anyway. But Mumia, even though they know that he's got this active case, that he has liver damage, and that it's caused his diabetes, too, they are not treating him.
That's in line with what our friend Francis Golden, who's one of the leaders of the Free Mumia campaign, believes, that they are now and have always been trying to execute him, and this is just another way to do it. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, medical execution.
So, David, at stake here, I guess, is not just the fate of Mumia, but other prisoners who are similarly situated. If the judge rules in Mumia's favor, then the state's going to have to come up with the money to treat other prisoners as well. Is that true?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, you know, Mumia's family and support group have offered to pay for the treatment. So, you know, if they'll allow him, they wouldn't even allow a private physician to examine him. There was an expert doctor brought in from New York to testify in this case, and that doctor, who's an internist and specializes in this stuff, he saw Mumia only because they wouldn't let him come in and examine him, but he came in as an ordinary visitor, and he looked at the visible signs of this skin rash and looked at Mumia as he was able to. He wasn't allowed to undress him and, you know, do a full exam, but he was able to talk to him and look at him, see his eyes, look at his, you know, the soft tissues on his eyes to see if there was liver damage and other things. And he was able to deduce that, yes, he has hep C, and yes, he has a diabetes, and yes, he needs to be treated. And so he testified about that. That they could bring in a doctor if the court ordered it, and then they could treat him that way. Or, you know, the doctor could simply order the hospital to treat him, you know, send him to the hospital and have him treated. But it would certainly look terrible to have him go to court and get this treatment under a federal court order without other prisoners getting. There are 10,000 prisoners in Pennsylvania with hep C, and usually a fair percentage of those are active cases statistically. You know, you would think the judge would simply say that this is unacceptable, and I suppose the judge could go beyond the injunction's request for Mumia to get treatment and order treatment for all prisoners.
Yeah, or a second lawsuit could be brought as a class action.
There is a second lawsuit that was brought in Pittsburgh. So there is an ongoing case that's, you know, moving through the courts. But the thing about Mumia is it adds urgency to the case because he collapsed within a diabetic coma and so on.
There's a doctor involved on the other side of this case, Dr. Jay Cowan. Could you give us, in a nutshell, some of what you know about the good doctor?
Yeah, well, one of the things that's come out in this is that health care in Pennsylvania prisons is being provided by a private for-profit firm called Horizon, which is based in Tennessee, home base of healthcare, you know, madness with Hospital Corporation of America. This company has a subsidiary that provides the doctors and nurses in their contracts, and the head of that subsidiary is this guy, Dr. J. Cowan, middle initial C. And I looked him up, and he's quite a piece of work. He was a medical student through the 80s, was CEO and president of the Health and Hospital System of Newark. Turns out he was indicted by the Attorney General. Both of them were indicted as co-conspirators for absconding with money through an insurance fraud scheme from that hospital, and he was dumped by the hospital in 1989. And then in 92 or 91, I'm sorry, the father pleaded guilty to a lesser charge and was given 3 years probation, 200 hours of public service, and had to repay the hospital $100,000 in absconded funds.
Isn't it true that Cowan, his outfit also provides medical care for the people at Rikers Island here in New York City?
Oh, yeah. They lost the contract earlier this year, and Florida dumped them from 44 hospitals that they were running down there. And in both cases, it was because of unnecessary deaths.
David, we've run out of time. We'll keep checking with you on updates on the Mumia case, and we thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you again.
Okay.
Miko Peled is an Israeli writer and activist currently living in the United States. He was born and raised in Jerusalem. His grandfather was a signer of the Israeli Declaration of Independence in 1948. And his father, the late General Mati Peled, was one of the generals in the 1967 Israeli-Arab War. Driven by a personal family tragedy to explore Palestine, its people, and their narrative, he has written a book about his journey from the sphere of the privileged Israeli to that of the oppressed Palestinians. His book is titled The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. He supports the creation of a single democratic state in all of Palestine, and he is a supporter of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Miko Peled, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Miko, you come from a distinguished Israeli family. Tell us about your grandfather and your father and your mother and your sister.
Well, I come from a very patriotic Zionist family, a family that has had its hand in the establishment of the State of Israel from the very, very beginning. From the early beginnings of the Zionist movement. My grandfather was Avram Katznelson, who was one of the early leaders of the Zionist movement. He was a signer on the Israeli Declaration of Independence. This was my maternal grandfather, my mother's side. On my father was a Mati Peled. He was an officer in 1948, and he remained in the Israeli army, and he was a general. He was a member of the Israeli High Command during the 1967 war and the years leading up to the 1967 war. And then after that war, he began to advocate this idea that today we know as a two-state solution, whereby the Palestinian question would be resolved by allowing the Palestinians to establish a small state in two areas that Israel determined, which are the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And then for the rest of his life, the remainder of his life, or actually the second half of his life, he was a proponent of this two-state solution and the peace agreement that would hopefully, or he was hoping, would come as a result of the solution, which we know never materialized, never happened. And yes, about my sister, she lost her daughter in a suicide attack in Jerusalem in 1997. She became a very strong advocate of peace and a very strong critic of the State of Israel, and she had written a book. She's an educator. She had written a book called Palestine and Israeli School Books, which analyzes closely the Israeli education system concluding that it is a systemically racist education system, which is very similar to the types of education systems we find in other racist societies. And then I am the author of The General Son, and I've been active for the last probably 15, almost 20 years as well on this issue. My take is slightly different. I'm a strong anti-Zionist. I have a strong anti-Zionist approach. My call is to support BDS and to establish a secular democratic state.
When you were growing up, what was the narrative about Zionism that you were taught? You've written that the story on which I was raised was a lie. So could you talk about what the narrative was that you were raised on and why it's a lie?
The Zionist narrative claims that we, the Jewish people, have returned to our rightful land, our rightful homeland, after 2,000 years in exile, that we are the descendants of the ancient Hebrews who used to live in that land some 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, and therefore it is ours, and now we are back to reclaim it. Because we are reasonable people, we accepted the partition resolution of 1947, allowing the Palestinians to remain, or the Arabs of Israel to remain and have some portion of the country as their own. And then they attacked us. We defended ourselves. We won. We asked the Arabs to stay, and they all left. So the refugee problem is not our problem. They choose to leave, and they left. And that's it. And that's the end of the story. And since then, we've been defending ourselves against Arabs who want to kill us. That's, in a nutshell, the Zionist narrative.
And the other side, the Palestinian narrative?
Well, the Palestinian narrative is interesting because, of course, the Palestinian narrative is a narrative that talks about dispossession and ethnic cleansing and terrorism of which they were victims. And nobody really accepted that narrative until about, let's say, 20 or 15 years ago when Israeli historians began validating that. When they looked into the Israeli archives and they looked at this history, and they began to validate, and I read their accounts, and then I began traveling and meeting Palestinians and hearing their accounts, which is how I became familiar with the Palestinian narrative, which is not really talked about in the West, and certainly not talked about in Israel. And so that was my introduction to it, and it talks about a massive campaign, well-planned, well-thought-out, of ethnic cleansing. I would call it genocide, that began as early as the Zionists were able to do it, but certainly immediately after the partition resolution of November 1947. It's a campaign of dispossession that continues to this day, an attempt to destroy the Palestinian people, take their land, and get rid of them as quickly as possible.
You were in the special forces in the Israeli army. You wore a red beret, and now you don't even live in Israel anymore. You live in San Diego, and you write that your journey to Palestine began in San Diego. How so?
Well, growing up, I grew up in Jerusalem, and probably even more so than any other Israeli city. Jerusalem is a segregated racist city. It's supposedly a mixed city, but it's a segregated racist city. And just like Israelis everywhere else around the country, you don't meet Palestinians, you don't know Palestinians, you don't see Palestinians. There's no interaction, there's no connection whatsoever, no relations whatsoever. So you grow up as an Israeli never meeting Palestinians. To grow up as an Israeli never meeting Palestinians is very common. My journey began in San Diego because that is where I began meeting Palestinians and hearing the Palestinian story and getting in touch with the Palestinian narrative for the first time. That's why I say my journey into Palestine began in San Diego, because it was through that I was able to then go back and begin this journey, you know, like the subtitle of a book, as of an Israeli in Palestine, recognizing that there is a Palestine, and venturing from my very safe and comfortable and privileged sphere as an Israeli to the sphere of the other, which is a very, very different sphere. It's a very short journey geographically, but it's a huge journey mentally and psychologically.
Miko, why do you say that the notion of a Jewish state is a crazy racist notion?
Because I believe it is. There's no reason that could possibly justify the establishment of a Jewish state or the creation of a Jewish state, certainly not in an Arab country, which is what Palestine is. Jews are not a nation, they're not a nationality, they're a religion. There are Argentinian Jews and Polish Jews and Russian Jews and French Jews and American Jews. And so this notion that Jews are a nationality is one of the myths that the Zionist movement created. Therefore, the idea that you establish a state for Jews only particularly in a country where there are others who are not Jews, is a crazy racist idea.
Well, Miko, this is Abdin Jabara, and I have your book here, The General Son, in front of me, and you refer to the Palestinians and the Jews as two nations in this book at points. And I'm just wondering about this whole issue about whether we have to fight and win the idea that Jews are only a religious group and not does not have a national characteristic before we can solve this problem. Because I understand from you in your advocacy of a single democratic state with equal rights that you do not recognize any national rights that Jews might have. Is that correct?
I think you have to differentiate Jews and Israelis. I don't think Jews have any kind of national identity, but Israelis are a new creation. You know, I compare them to the whites in South Africa. They're not organic, they're not indigenous, but they are part of South Africa now. There's nothing anybody can do about that. Israelis are this new creation of Jews who immigrated and colonized, or not immigrated, but came to colonize Palestine. So Israelis are now this new national identity and cultural identity, and they are Israelis. So I don't think Jews have any kind of rights to Palestine. However, the reality is that half of the people who reside in Palestine today are Israelis, like myself. It's a different, they're not Arabs, they're not Palestinians, they're Israelis. So we do have two nations there. That exists there, and I think I don't think there's any expectation that anybody's going to leave or go anywhere. We're talking about 6 million Palestinians and about almost 6 million Israelis. So that is the reality that exists today. And again, I don't think it's a Jewish issue. I think it's the two nations that we need to be discussing are the Palestinians and the Israelis.
So you're considering the Israelis as a nation, is that correct?
The Israelis are this new nation, yes, this new creation, okay. Absolutely.
Now, you, I'm sure, follow the polls in Israel and understand what people's attitudes are. And I'm just wondering, on the basis of those polls, do you have any sense about how many Israeli Jews would find your proposal for a solution to the conflict acceptable?
None whatsoever. But I don't think that's the issue. I don't think this is going to be resolved as a result of Israelis accepting this. I think it's going to be resolved as Israelis waking up one morning and realizing there's a new reality in spite of what they might want. I think if we took a poll of white South Africans, they would have preferred apartheid to remain the reality in South Africa, but there was boycott, divestment, sanctions. South Africa was isolated, and the white apartheid regime had no choice but to fall, and the whites had no choice but to accept a new reality where they live as equals with black Africans. And Israelis, I believe, this is exactly the reality that's going to take place. It's not going to happen as a result of negotiations or concessions or Israelis suddenly waking up one morning and agreeing. It's going to be a reality where the force of the resistance, both from within and without, overpowers the reality of the Zionist state, the state of Israel. And an Israeli prime minister, just like de Klerk in South Africa, will step up one day and say, you know, we're calling for the release of all the prisoners and free one-person, one-vote elections for everyone.
There are at least 1 million Israelis that are living either in the United States or in Western Europe. To what extent is this message of a single democratic state more acceptable to them?
I don't think there's any difference. Most Israelis, even Israelis who live overseas, support the state of Israel. But, you know, there's immigration in and out of every country. I think that's a natural course of things. Most Israelis, I don't expect they're going to leave one way or the other. So I think the reality is that we have Israelis in Palestine, just like we have Palestinians. That's the reality that we need to move forward, with which we need to, you know, move forward. So I think Israelis and Palestinians can live in peace and can share Palestine, can have a peaceful coexistence, but not in the context of or in the framework of the state of Israel, only in the context where they are treated as equals in a democracy, which is not a Jewish state, but the state of all of its people.
Well, there have been four majority Arab or majority Arab-Palestinian parties in Israel that recently formed a joint list. They were forced to do so because of a new law that was passed by the Knesset that required parties to get a certain percentage of votes before they could stand for election in the Knesset. This party, the Joint List, as you know, is now headed by Ayman Oda, who recently visited the United States. My question is, do you have any sense about how many Jews voted for the United List?
Well, the very progressive, not many, but the very progressive fringe Israelis that voted for them. But this is the very, very fringe left. Most of the Israeli, what used to be the Israeli Zionist left, voted for other parties. So these would be Israelis who are non-Zionist or who are, basically non-Zionist and don't believe in the Zionist call. But not many, but certainly enough to make a little bit of a difference.
I think that all pro-Palestinian activists would like to see a radical transformation in the Palestinian situation and end to the massive oppression that they have faced on a daily basis, both before and after 1948. And I'm just wondering, from what I hear, that you think that there's going to be some leader, some Israeli leader is going to emerge like a de Klerk and say, well, we've got to change and we've got to give rights to these people. Do you really think that that is a realistic expectation?
No, not at all, not at all. Let me rephrase it, because that's not what I meant. So let me correct that. What I meant to say is that, like de Klerk, there will be an Israeli prime minister who will be forced as a result of the total isolation, boycotts, and divestments, and so forth, not out of the goodness of his heart or out of some kind of magnanimity, but as a result of lack of choice. De Klerk didn't do what he did because he woke up one morning feeling magnanimous. He did what he did because apartheid was dying and South Africa was isolated and there was nowhere to go. There was no other choice. It was complete surrender. So I foresee an Israeli prime minister one day in the same position, forced to stand up and surrender, basically, like de Klerk did.
Do you see that the West, the United States, and European countries are going to provide the same kind of isolation of Israel that they ultimately provided for South Africa that led to de Klerk's seeing the light?
Absolutely. I don't think de Klerk saw the light. I think de Klerk just saw that there was no choice. But yeah, I think absolutely. That's exactly how it's going to be.
You criticize the new measures by the Europeans to label the goods from the settlements that are being sold in Europe. You say that all of Israel is being occupied. It's not just the West Bank. It's not just Gaza. And to single out these settlement products is nonsensical, if that's what I understand your position.
Yeah, I think I don't think that hope is going to come necessarily of the current European or American regimes. It's going to come as a result of greater greater grassroots pressure on them to move forward. What the Europeans have been doing with the recognition of the Palestinian state and this new law about the labels is trying to, within the framework of the reality that exists today, which recognizes the occupation of Palestine, to show some measure of resistance and say, look, we're doing something for the Palestinians. So we're recognizing a state that does not exist. We're pretending that there is a Palestinian ambassador, although there is no Palestinian state, so the ambassador represents no one. Along that same line, they're saying, well, we're going to label these, we're going to consider those particular areas as illegal settlements, and those are the ones that we're going to label. And then go figure out exactly which ones are they're going to consider the illegal and which ones are not. You know, how exactly they're going to do this is a whole other question. So it's a small measure that just to relieve some of the pressure and show that they are showing some measure of respect and solidarity with the Palestinian cause, but in effect doing nothing. You know, if they wanted to really do something, they would say we are boycotting all Israeli products because all of Israel is occupied Palestine. All Israeli towns and cities are illegal settlements, which is what they are. The occupation of 48 was no more legal than the occupation that, you know, that took place in 1967. And one was a continuation of the other. If they wanted to do something, they would say, we recognize that all of Palestine is occupied, that Palestinians live under an oppressive apartheid regime that needs to end. Not recognize a state that doesn't exist and a government that represents no one, which is really what the Palestinian Authority is. So if the Europeans, but I believe that this is coming. I think right now the Europeans are behaving the way they are because they can get away with it. I think future European governments are not going to be able to get away with it because the pro-Palestinian voice in Europe is getting stronger and louder, and their constituents are going to demand that they do more.
We've been speaking with Miko Peled, the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. The book, I should mention, has a foreword by Alice Walker. Miko, you write towards the end of your book that, quote, in the long run, the Zionist state is a disaster for Jews, as well as it is for Palestinians. It completely undermined, not to say destroyed, Jewish culture and traditions, both European and Middle Eastern. Can you expand on that thought?
Well, you know, here in America, there used to be, and in Europe certainly too, there used to be a real Jewish culture, a European Jewish culture. There was language, there was literature, there was poetry, there was activism. They spoke Yiddish, they wrote in Yiddish, and they were activists, and they were progressive, and they were anarchists, and there was a whole culture of Jews. All of that has been replaced by this new fake religion called the State of Israel. And today, Jews, in order to identify yourself as a Jew, you have to support the State of Israel. So Zionism killed it and took over. In terms of Arab Jews, there used to be rich, flourishing Arab Jewish communities, and they're all gone. And they're only gone because Zionism created this rift between Jewish communities in the Arab world and the Arab world. And so those are gone. And then the Arab Jews who did come to Palestine had to, and become Israelis, had to sound like me and look like me, which is European. So their culture in Israel was also destroyed. And therefore I say that Zionism was a disaster and destructive for Jews as well as Palestinians. Jewish culture was destroyed as a result of it.
We've unfortunately run out of time. It's really been a pleasure and an honor to speak with you. I'll just repeat, you were the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. We recommend it to our audience, and we're grateful for your being on Law and Disorder. You take it easy, and I hope we get a chance to speak again.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Against Iraq, originally called Operation Iraqi Liberation, that is OIL, was not fought, as we can clearly see now, to bring freedom and democracy to Iraq. But what about World War II, often called the Good War? There were socialists who were indicted, tried, and convicted and imprisoned for opposing the American government's aims in World War II, which they said was an imperialist war for markets and territories. They were falsely accused of conspiracy to overthrow the American government by force and violence, a thought crime, and imprisoned in Minnesota before the American government got involved in the war. That is, they were imprisoned during peacetime. This was accomplished by the Roosevelt administration, urged on by J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. The indictments and convictions were secured under the recently passed Alien and Registration Act, known as the Smith Act, named after its sponsor, Howard K. Smith, a Southern anti-labor racist Democratic senator. Back then in 1941, fear was marshaled against socialists who were union leaders in Minnesota. They were called subversives, and fear was used then as it is now, to scapegoat Muslims as terrorists. Here today to talk about her new book, Trotskyists on Trial, Free Speech and Political Persecution Since the Age of FDR, is Hunter College professor Donna Haverte Stack.
Donna, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We're thrilled about your new book, and we'd like to start by asking you for an overview of the Smith Act. What was it? When was it passed? And who objected to it, and on what grounds?
Sure, sure. The Smith Act was the first peacetime sedition law since 1798. It was passed in June of 1940, and it made the advocacy of the violent overthrow of the government illegal. It also made it illegal to write, print, publish, distribute anything that advocated the same or to belong to any organization that advocated the same. And at the time, its supporters came largely from Southern Democrats, its sponsor Howard Smith, as well as members of the military who were concerned with what they perceived to be the threat of fifth columnists in the United States in the mid to late 30s. And they wanted a statute to criminalize this advocacy because it also had a component of advocating disloyalty in the armed forces. Because since the nation was at peace, the Espionage Act was no longer in force. So that was a large impetus for the measure from its supporters. Its detractors, which were largely the ACLU at the time, but others as well, who testified during the hearings, first in the House in the summer of 39 and then in the Senate in the summer of 40, were deeply concerned about essentially two things, that this was a peacetime measure. There was some acceptance even among liberals coming out of the first Red Scare that in times of war, certain trade-offs may need to be made between liberty and security. This was something that was evolving at the time and informed this debate. But there was deep concern about having these kinds of restrictions in during peacetime. Their other chief concern about the law was that it criminalized advocacy, that this was about pure speech, that it was not linked to any overt acts, and that was deeply disturbing. Osmond Frankel of the ACLU was one of the leading objectors to that. And in terms of Congress, the only person who spoke out on the floor of the House was Vito Marcantonio, who saw through this and saw the essence of the danger of this law to speech and to dissent.
Yeah, the force and violence provision. That's if the prosecutor says, you're going to use force and violence, and the defendant says, no, I'm not. And the prosecutor says, yes, you are, but there's no act.
Right.
So is it a question of kind of a historical overview, or is it an immediate counseling people to use force? You know, it's speech.
Right.
And they're outlawing speech here.
Right, right.
And I think that was the contention.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And that, what you're speaking to really came out in the trial, the first Smith Act trial. That's the center subject of my book. That was the bone of contention between the prosecution and the defense, this issue of, were these members of the Socialist Workers Party, many of whom, 15 of whom, were affiliated with Local 544 in Minneapolis, advocating this violent overthrow of the government? And how do you prove that? How do you prove something that has yet to happen, in a sense? You know, that there was no overt act. And that became a central bone of contention. The defense very much wanting to apply the clear and present danger test protectively to their case so that they could prove that they were not an imminent or serious threat, that they were a legitimate political party, that they had a right to their positions, particularly their opposition to the war, which we could talk about in a moment, which is one of the reasons why they were targeted, that they really saw this as an issue of speech, that their ideas might be unpopular, but they had a right to those ideas. Whereas the government was pursuing, I think looking back, we can consider somewhat disturbing a line in prosecuting these individuals and arguing that the only thing they needed to prove was a conspiracy to advocate a sort of blanket conspiracy charge, and that there didn't need to be a link to overt acts, and that they just needed to essentially prove that it was really their beliefs that were then put on trial, right? And then that's the socialism was on trial, became part of the argument there.
Donna, let's take a quick step back and lay out the procedural history of the trial itself so listeners know exactly what we're talking about.
Right, right.
Yes, especially, I think, the people who were on trial. You can tell us a little bit about about some of the significant figures.
How did we get into the courtroom in the first place?
Yeah, what, what did they do?
Right. Well, I think it's sort of what they didn't do. It was more of what they believed and what they were saying, right? So the first group of people who were prosecuted under this law, they were arrested in June of 1941, and they were indicted by a federal grand jury in July of 1941. There were 29 defendants, 15 of whom belonged to the Teamsters Local 544 in Minneapolis, including Vincent Dunn, Farrell Dobbs, Max Geldman, Edward Palmquist, and there were leaders from the Socialist Workers Party from New York who were also indicted, James Cannon, Albert Goldman, and other party organizers, including Grace Carlson from Minneapolis. So they were targeted in part because of their opposition to the war. They remained opposed to the war throughout, unlike the Communist Party USA members who, after the invasion of the Soviet Union, shifted and began calling for the opening of the Second Front. The Trotskyists, these members of the Socialist Workers Party, remained opposed to the war. Did not mean they supported Hitler, obviously. They were opposed to fascism. They just felt that this war was a capitalist war and it would not be the way to defeat fascism in its entity.
But, they Donna, let me just interrupt you for a second to explain to our listeners what the union leaders in Minneapolis had done.
Oh, sure. The other reason why they were got on the lens of the Justice Department and the FBI in particular, and I think we need to talk about the role of the FBI in this because it's really key. They had a history. They were militant. They were militant trade union organizers, militant industrial unionists. They had led the famous strikes in 1934, the truck driver strikes, which really were significant in labor history in that they turned what had been an open shop town into one that accepted and recognized unions. That was a very significant fight and got them on the radar of the FBI and the Justice Department because they managed to shut down the city in their activities in 34. This became part of the narrative and part of the anxieties on the part of J. Edgar Hoover that these folks were in positions of power and influence within a union that was important to the economy in the Northwest, that is truck driving, and that if they were opposed to the war, that they could somehow snap their fingers and shut down transport and impede the war preparedness program. This was the logic that you see in the internal documents in the declassified files. Part of the reason why they were considered such an imminent threat, even though, as we mentioned a moment ago, that didn't happen. They didn't actually engage in that overt act of halting trucking because of their political beliefs, but this was the fear that was fueling the perception of them as a threat that tied to their political beliefs and the role of these individuals in particular in the Teamsters Union and the role of that in the economy vis-a-vis the preparedness program. That was sort of the pieces of the puzzle, as it were. The FBI then had them on their radar and not only had them under surveillance, they being the Trotskyists in Local 544.
Kind of a precursor, if I may, to COINTELPRO.
Absolutely. You know, what you see with this case is tactics of COINTELPRO before COINTELPRO. The Trotskyists, you sort of experience this from as early as 1940 all the way through the 20th century. And that's one of the other strands of the book that I follow, is this unfolding of the national security state or the domestic security state, that we see this beginning, as I said, as early as I can find, it may have gone back earlier in 1940, where they are being under surveillance and there are also informants and people infiltrating the union that then intensified an independent internal opposition movement within Local 544, the sort of infamous Committee of 100 that emerges in early 1941 among a group of disgruntled union members who didn't like the leadership of Dunn and Dobbs and others in the union, claimed that they were trying to make the union arm of the party. That story is well known within Socialist Worker Party circles, within labor history to a certain extent. And the generally accepted narrative to date has been that the reason why these individuals were targeted for prosecution in the summer of 1941 was the telegram that Daniel Tobin, the president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, sent to President Roosevelt, flagging the dangerousness of these people in Local 544 and essentially all but asking for them to be prosecuted. And I argue yes and no, that clearly was an important part of the story, but that I think it was actually much worse in that, looking at the declassified files now, we see the FBI was already heavily involved in the case well before the summer of 41, and the Justice Department as well. In April of 41, there's correspondence identifying this as a possible violation of the Smith Act. They're already getting ready to move on these people before Tobin sends his telegram. I think Tobin's telegram gives the Roosevelt administration political cover and can say, we didn't unfairly, you know, raid this union. We didn't intervene here. We were asked to come in. So there's that story, that little piece of the backstory I try to complicate. And I think the evidence shows that, again, it's worse because of the FBI was there playing that role, and I think gave legs to what would have been just a group of disgruntled union members who may not have been able to do much with their opposition. They were a very small percentage of the total union of 6,000 members.
They were getting support from the FBI.
They were getting support and legitimacy and a patriotic sheen to their cause, and that, you know, again gave them legs that they might not have had otherwise.
We're speaking with Donna Haverty Stack, who just had published an excellent book, which I recommend to all of our listeners, called Trotskyists on Trial, Free Speech and Political Persecution Since the Age of FDR. And I was just going to make an observation, Donna. I read the trial transcript when James P. Cannon testified. It's published in a book, as you know, called
right.
Socialism on Trial, right. Which is still available.
Yes.
It really is quite a good primer on what socialism is. Mm. And Cannon was questioned by his attorney on direct, and Cannon says, we're not for force and violence, but we're for self-defense, same thing that Malcolm X used to say. If, for example, the 1% doesn't like it that we've taken over the oil and gas industry and we're keeping oil in the ground and gas in the ground, and the 1% tries to use violence against us, we'll defend ourselves.
Right.
And he explains that in his testimony. And I thought that was extremely crucial. The other thing I wanted to ask you about was the kind of defense that was marshaled in favor of these people, because they didn't go quietly into prison. As you said, the ACLU supported them, Roger Baldwin, and many others. And when I read your book, I thought it was particularly important what you said about a lot of these people that were eventually imprisoned had come out of the IWW, which is, you know, the great precursor to the CIO and wonderful syndicalist union in the early days. And they were famous, of course, for their free speech fights.
Right, of course, right.
And they knew how to organize.
Right, yeah.
And Cannon, the main defendant, and Vincent Dunn, another of the main defendants, had been in the IWW. So I was interested in reading in your book how they defended themselves. They organized the, what was it called, the
Civil Rights Defense Committee.
Civil Rights Defense Committee. And they got this famous author at the time, James T. Farrell, to be the honorary chairman.
Right.
And George Novak was the secretary of it. He was one of the people they call the New York intellectuals.
Right, right.
And they got all kinds of support. They asked for support from across the movement with people with moral authority, and they got it. Mm. And they published pamphlets. They went on speaking tours. Mm. They really laid out the template, I think, for how the movement defends itself now. Mm. I think that's another reason for reading your excellent book.
You referred to the what becomes known as the Cannon-Goldman exchange during the trial, because Goldman is the defense lawyer as well as one of the defendants. And that became famous and somewhat infamous within the party, in that there were those, some in the party, who criticized Cannon and Goldman for not being revolutionary enough in their stance on in the trial. And I touch upon that in the book, and Cannon defends his position as 100% correct, as he says, in that they were walking a fine line, and they had vowed before they went into the trial to not go as supplicants or as those who were defeated, but as advocates for their cause. And they were going to turn the tables and sort of put the government on trial and put the capitalist system on trial and use it as an educational forum in so far as they could, as well as defending themselves. And you're right, he does make the case. It's interesting that you mentioned Malcolm X in terms of the use of violence in a purely defensive. I think of Albert Parsons similarly making this case in Haymarket trial. And this was something that came out not only in Cannon's testimony, but also in Grace Carlson's. There were prosecution witnesses who claimed that she had said certain things in speeches she gave on college campuses and sort of misinterpreting their socialist message. And what they were trying to do was to clarify that in the course of their testimony, that what they were talking about was not advocating violence, but predicting the violence that would come in reaction from revolution that they could not foment, because that had to come of itself as capitalism's own collapse, but that they would seek to lead and direct. And so they were walking this fine line within the parameters of the Smith Act, trying to make the case that they weren't advocating the violent overthrow of the government in the way that the law was construed. And so that was essential to their defense. But in terms of the organizing, once they are convicted, 18 of them are ultimately convicted of violating the Smith Act. That was count two of the indictment. There was another count that they were indicted under, which was a Civil War insurrection statute, which was linked to the Union Defense Guard. This was an actual claim for overt acts of insurrection, which was just thrown out. The jury didn't take that seriously. There was no evidence that their group of 600 men that came together in 1938 to defend the Union against the fascist silver shirts, defend their Union property, defend themselves, and then essentially devolved into doorkeepers at the holiday party. they were not the kernel of a proletarian army, as the government tried to make them out to be. That was directed by Trotsky. That no one was convicted under that count. That was clearly just, I have to say, sort of laughable. So that was thrown out. But 18 of the 29 were ultimately convicted of the Smith Act convictions, those who were most tightly linked to the party, who had made speeches or who had written things that allegedly contained these violent advocacy expressions. And so then after they're convicted, what you were talking about with the Civil Rights Defense Committee, they launched this amazing campaign, first to appeal, and that appeal lasts from, they are convicted December of 1941. They were sentenced December 8th, 1941, the day after Pearl Harbor, which was pretty astonishing. Dobbs recalls that he was convinced they were going to be thrown away and never to be seen again. It was not an easy time for them, you can imagine, right? But they launched this campaign from December of 41 until the fall of 43. And in between that period, the Eighth Circuit Court upheld the conviction. At every chance they got, they were trying to argue for the clear and present danger test to be applied protectively, meaning the way in which Holmes articulated it in the Abrams case, not the way he initially articulated in Schenck. In Schenck, clear and present danger was actually devised to make the case that there is no such thing as absolute free speech. There has to be certain restraints given certain circumstances, depends on the circumstance. In Abrams, Holmes re-articulated that and used it in a protective fashion. And that was what these defendants were appealing to. And that was a debate that was going on in the wider culture that they were tapping into among civil libertarians, the ACLU, the left liberal press, the Nation, the Republic. They all came out against this because it was about just mere political advocacy, many people thought. And many, they were brilliant in doing this. As you said, it's a model for this kind of progressive organizing, widening your reach, finding common interest, and even folks who came and spoke out and said, look, I don't agree with what they're saying. I don't agree with their political position, but I agree with their right to say it. They were able to build that through the CRDC, through the ACLU, and NAACP branches, seeing the writing on the wall that this could possibly hurt their fight for civil rights. They were able to build that.
Donna, we just have a few minutes remaining, but I wanted to also touch on one of the points that you describe as another great debate in the country, namely of the balance between national security and liberties in times of stress. And this certainly resonates with listeners right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was eerie when I was working on this book to sense those links. When I was reading through these documents, looking at the debates around the time the law was, the committee hearings, when the Smith Act was being put together, going through the legislative process, looking at the speeches in Congress, looking at the writings of lawyers in the Bill of Rights Review in 1941, and Francis Biddle, who becomes the Attorney General who authorizes the prosecution, grappling with this and seeing, you know, people really struggling with a sense of fear. At the time, it was a fear of internal subversion on the part of either Nazis or communists, the Little Red Scare and the Fifth Column fear of 38 through 41. And then the outbreak of the war abroad, and which seemed to justify this fear of Fifth Column danger with the sort of misinterpretation of what happens in the Blitzkrieg, but it gave fuel to that fire. But what really struck me was something Biddle said in a piece that he wrote, where he talked about America being in this twilight zone, where it wasn't yet in the war, but the war was happening, and there was these wartime, we were in a wartime emergency, and we were gearing up, but we weren't at war. And it just echoed so much, or resonated so much with me, with the kind of place we've been in since 9/11, where we're at war, but we're not at war. And this great debate of, in wartime emergency, many people, not all, but many people have accepted there needs to be some suspension of liberties. They accept this trade-off. But as Mary Dudzak has argued in her wonderful book, Wartime, what do you do when you're permanently at war? Do you then suspend civil liberties forever? How do you, you can't live like that.
I think that what Cannon said was true, that socialists are for majority rule. Mm. And that if people want to change the system, it's going to have to be people who do it for themselves, by themselves, and not any kind of a conspiracy. Mm. And that's so well articulated, I think, in his testimony. But I wanted to ask you to bring this up to date, because like you say, COINTELPRO got its birth then, but it continued on. And I think it's on steroids now, really, with the Patriot Act and the rest of the surveillance that's going on. Every stroke on your computer, every phone call you make on your iPhone, and so on. They know it all. And I think the commonality between what's going on now with this, what you call perpetual war since Iraq, is fear.
I mean, that's the thing. You know, I know when the Snowden revelations came out and it was all over the news, and there was this sense of, you know, what is this? And this is all, and I was writing this book and I'm thinking, this is not new. This is, there's a long history to this. It's maybe the technology has changed, but this is not new. And that's what you see here, that from, you know, as I said, as early as 1940 all the way through. And it's interesting you mentioned COINTELPRO, because one of the reasons, and I think historians agree on this, one of the reasons why Hoover devises that program is because the Smith Act is defanged in the Yates decision, and they can't go through that to seek prosecution, so they're going to go around it with that secret program of not just surveillance, but active harassment and infiltration of dissent movements. And then there's a rebalancing with the Church Committee to a certain extent. But since 9/11, there's been, you know, various attempts to find legal authority to grow the intelligence. Again, I think Mary Dudzak is very good on this, and David Cole obviously has written a lot about this, about we can still accept and agree that there are real threats in the world and real threats here at home. And, you know, fear is there, but it's how do you deal with the fear? Do you overreact? Do you panic? Do you strip the country of its rights? Or do you think more sort of strategically and smart in the ways in which you try to devise security measures? And I think that, you know, blanket lists and blanket surveillance, you can't even probe all that information. How does that make us safer? You know, all the discussion about watch lists. Well, Hoover had a custodial detention list in 1939. Again, nothing new. The sad thing is we don't seem to be learning from the history, and we don't seem to be finding a way to realize that it's a false dichotomy, liberty and security, that I think we need to find ways to have both.
Well said. Donna Haverty-Stack, who has just had her excellent book, Trotskyists on Trial, Free Speech and Political Persecution Since the Age of FDR, come out. It's published by NYU. We'd recommend it to everybody. It's a really excellent book.
Donna, thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Donna.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
Said. We've been speaking with Donna Haverty-Stack, who has just had her excellent book, Trotskyists on Trial, Free Speech and Political Persecution Since the Age of FDR, come out. It's published by NYU. We'd recommend it to everybody. It's a really excellent book.
Donna, thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Donna.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
use that so much, yeah.